And I thought, to be honest, I thought there'd be sort of a cryonics organization around the corner or every main city, and that wasn't the case.
Greetings to your listeners. I'm your host, Max Marty.
And I'm your host, Daniel Walters.
And you're listening to the one and only Cryonics Underground podcast. On this episode, we're speaking with Peter Solokiedis. Peter is the founder and director of Southern Cryonics, a cryonics service organization down in Australia and New Zealand. Today, we talk about a bunch of related topics to the creating of an organization, a new cryonics service organization, some of the particular issues around starting an organization like this in Australia. Also, there have been a few updates since we recorded the episode. The facility down in Australia is now fully built out. All the major equipment is going to be arriving soon. It's on order. And the personnel training around the process of putting a person into cryonics and such is planned for early fourth quarter of this year. So assuming that COVID doesn't dig its way out of the grave that we are hopefully putting it into, we should be looking at the opening of Southern Cryonics by the end of the year, if all goes well. So without further ado, I bring you Peter Solokiedis. Peter Solokiedis, welcome to the Cryonics Underground podcast.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you very much.
And we wanted to start today by talking a little bit about you. So it takes a pretty big and serious effort to create a cryonics organization, right? It's not like what we're, it's not like creating a website or even what we're doing here, creating a podcast. It takes, it's legally, technically, practically an enormous undertaking. So I can't imagine that just anybody would have the gumption to do this or the interest in doing something like this. So what drove you to want to create an organization doing cryonics down in Australia?
Okay, I think, and again, I just have to go to a little bit of background. I became interested in cryonics when I read Robert Ettinger's book, The Prospect of Immortality, around the late 60s. So that sort of dates me, and you can work out my age from that. So I read it, but it's something that I thought to myself sounded a really good idea, but later on, it'll be easily available. So I put it to the side. I didn't worry too much about it at that time. So years went past. I followed my career. I did everything I was supposed to do. And then I retired about 10 years ago. And I thought, to be honest, I thought there'd be sort of a cryonics organization around the corner or every main city. And that wasn't the case. So what happened was, after I retired, I returned to Australia. I'd traveled. Most of my career has been overseas. I've been in Japan, in Thailand, in the US, in England, pick the places, but most of my career was overseas. So I then went back to Australia, and I started checking around what we had in Australia as far as cryonics. There were a few people. It was a very volunteer group, and it's still a volunteer group. Cryonics tend to be that way. But it was a group of very... an amateur approach, but people who were very dedicated to all this thing. So we got together, we talked a while, and we ended up saying that we really need something in Australia because, and this is really to answer your question, the logistics of getting to the US was almost impossible. It was there, you could do it, you could do all the preparation that you needed to do, and then you could send people over there. But now that I know a lot more of it, I probably... at that time would have thought it was really impossible to do it. So the big issue, the big thing about it all was the logistics. How do you get somebody? Because, you know, again, let me drift a little bit to the side, but everybody sees the shiny cylinders, the shiny cryostats, and they think that's cryonics. To be honest, the biggest part of cryonics is getting to somebody quickly and then getting them to the facility as quickly as possible with all the right preparations and things that have to happen in between. So that was the most critical part. So we said to do that in Australia, we needed to build a facility here. So that was sort of what started it all. There were two or three of us at the time. That group has changed a little bit, but at the moment, I'm sort of the key person through most of this at the moment.
And
you said you had a career here in the United States. Was your career at all related to this field? Were you in
not
biomedical
really.
Field? Or, you
no,
know,
nothing to do with that. There's only one aspect that probably has something to do with that. I was in the oil industry, and I worked in marketing. I worked in strategic planning. I worked in major project planning and development. So doing a project like this, we say I'd worked on hundreds of millions of dollar projects. So this project is not a big deal to do, but there are its own complications. Chronix is not where a big multi-billion dollar company is backing you and you do something. There were big complications in itself, but I'd had a lot of background in planning. I'm great at modeling economic forecasts for what they're worth. So I've got all our plans modeled all out, great in computer modeling, that is. But and I've also worked on the ground marketing. I mean, actually being there, doing all the practical things and all the rest related to marketing. So that was my background. I did that in many countries.
So it's interesting. Your experience coming to Chronix and kind of waiting around, hoping that someone was going to eventually create it, is very similar to Robert Ettinger himself, who had a very similar experience in which he was, in his younger years, was hoping someone was going to do it. In fact, he was somewhat sure that someone was going to do it. And when he realized, you know, that it was nobody was doing it, he, you know, sprung into action. So
I didn't know that because I'd read his book, but I didn't know all the background to it. But I think it happens with a lot of people. A lot of people who are even now interested thought when they were younger it would be easily available. And in some ways too, my background is in science. I mean, my degree is in science, in chemistry, chemical engineering. So, you know, even though I haven't worked much in that area, I've always been interested in the science aspects of all this as well. So, and the economics experts, because I was, there's a whole lot, there's so many parts of Chronix that are areas that interest me. The science, the planning, the economics, the financial forecasting, all the rest of it. And of course, the medical, which is part of the science and all the rest. So I see this as something for retirement, which was a great thing to keep me occupied because it hit every one of the dots that I wanted or any one of the targets that I wanted that really interested me. So, all right. I'm answering your question, but that's my thinking on it.
That's the great thing about a podcast. We can really get into the details.
Okay.
Did you when you were spending time in the U.S. did you spend a lot of time over in Detroit or in Phoenix looking at what they're doing or
nothing? I was on my career at that time. When I came to Australia, though, when I came back to Australia and got involved in starting the organization here, I visited Phoenix, I visited Elcor in Phoenix, I visited Chronix Institute in Detroit. I also went to the UK to see what they had, and the relevance of that too is also important to what we're doing. And they were really, really friendly with me. I mean, I could not believe what a great organization the Chronix community is. So they helped me a lot. A lot of what we're doing is really because of all the help I got from all those organizations. If I had to do it from scratch, I think I wouldn't be able to do it. So that might
would you
be.
Say you learned some lessons from some things they did right and some things they did wrong?
I learned probably everything I learned. There is some differences in Australia. You know, where the distance is the big difference in Australia, and also some of the ability to get the resources is not as easy in Australia. And you know, if you want to get into all the economics aspects, I can go into that. But it's a lot different model. But the basic nuts and bolts of what you do, what you shouldn't do, the organizations that lasted, like Elcor and CI, what they did right. Let me summarize in a word. They were professional. The organizations that I saw overseas were professional. They were volunteers. Some were being paid, some were not being paid, but they were very professional in how they handled things. And when I read back about some of the organizations that failed, to me, it lacked that professionalism. It was like somebody did something in their back shed, you know, said, that's all right, we'll just do it here. And in fact, some of the people I was involved with here when we first got started, in my mind, we didn't have the same approach in that professionalism. It was, you know, we could do something quickly and then you know, if you build it, they'll come sort of thing. Whereas my approach is very different. I've got a big plan. That's the big lessons I learned from them. You have to do this in all aspects as professional a way as what you can. And I'll develop that later if you want. But at the moment, that's the summary part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to, you know, come into all types of details going forward. But on this specific topic, so is there anything you also felt that you saw the other Chronics organizations doing that you wanted to avoid doing or do differently?
I'm thinking because they are different organizations. We took an approach which was will hopefully be the best of both. Chronics Institute is a very low-cost, professional but low-cost organization. They do things as efficiently and as low-cost as what they can, and they have their prices very low too because of that, the cost of getting suspended. Alcor is a more, let's say, higher cost operation. You know, but both of them are very good. Both of them handle what they're doing, but they're a different style of operation. They have more people at Alcor, probably more paid people. At least they did when I visited. But again, very professional. They do everything very well. It's not something that you'd say either one. They just run on a different model. Our model is, and the model is an economic model. You know, I can show you. That's why I'm pleased I have that background. But it's an economic model. Our model is somewhere in between both of them. But I won't go into what their models are because that gets into some of the private areas that they have. You know, I did some work with them also looking at their modeling and the way they look at the future and how each of them views things. So I won't go into that because that's their own private way in which they do things. But they have a different model as to how they operate.
I have some background in starting new companies and new projects, but no idea what it would take to or what the right approach would be to start a cryonics organization like you have. So when you were considering this, what was step one? Was it to create a business plan? Was it to think about what is the minimum viable product, you know, and then look for investors? Actually, maybe even explain, you know, were you thinking about this in nonprofit ways, such as the organizations here in the United States, or are you thinking about this in some other legal entity? Does that work the same in Australia as it does in the US?
There's a lot there.
I'm peppering you with these things.
No, good, please. And if I miss out on it, please just say, Peter, you didn't cover that part. We did a business plan at first. That was because that's my background. My background is to actually do business plans on all things. I've done so many startup of organizations in countries, but again, I've been backed by a multi-billion-dollar organization. It wasn't like mine. But the first thing I did a business plan, and the first thing we did was I worked out this would have to be done with this certain number of investment. We needed this level of investment, which we developed how we would do the investment. On top of that, we said it needed to be a non-profit. Chronics, by its nature, happens to be a non-profit enterprise. People buy into it a lot more if they think it's been run and operated on a non-profit basis. So there will be employees, but there's a lot of volunteer work involved. Chronics people tend to be very dedicated too, so it's not that hard to get people. It might be hard to get people to start the organization, but once you're running, a lot of people I've got this big list of people who say, we volunteer to help you do this, and we'll volunteer to help you do that, and we'll volunteer to help you. So Chronics is, I hate to use a word like this because it's not, but it's like a priesthood. you have that continuation of the priesthood because you probably need it over the hundreds of years that you might be operating. It's not like a corporation. And there's also another reason why it has to be, it's to do with the economics. Not that many people are interested in chronics, and I'll get back to that later. You know, I'll come back to that later because that's an issue. So the first thing we did was build a business plan. We said that we needed a certain number. We said we would have what we call investors. They're really founding members. We said we would need at least, and those days it was 12, but we said we needed 12 paying $50,000 Australian dollars to be viable. You know, that's what my plan does. It goes out 100 years. And of course, you know, we can't even forecast what's happening next year, but my plan will tell you what's happening in 100 years time. So, you know, I know the weaknesses of financial forecasts. Their only strength, just to give an aside, is basically to find out when things are, what the sensitivities are to your starting conditions. That's the best thing you get from, but anyway, so we figured we needed 12. We waited too long to do things. There were, because you had to learn your way through. There was government issues to cover, all the rest. And then we were about ready. We bought some land and we were about ready to start. But my numbers now showed we needed 18, and we didn't have 18. We had 12. Okay. So we needed 18 to get going. We needed 18 of these founding members. The founding members, as I said, are like investors. They put in about 50,000, not about exactly 50,000 Australian dollars each. Then what happened was we stopped. We got into a slight disagreement within the organization. I said, we're not moving until we get 18. Others wanted to move, et cetera. And I'm very conservative in my economics. I go for the worst possible case. So basically, we ended up going for the 18 case. So I went out and started looking for more investors. It was almost word of mouth. It's not, you know, you asked the question about media. Media almost played no part in it at all. We probably got hundreds of thousands of dollars of free advertising, and not one of our investors came from the television, from the TV advertising, from the radio advertising, from the newspaper stuff. That's all just interest stuff. People like it because it's a fringe science area and they like it for interest, but they don't actually, you don't get the investors that way. So it was word of mouth, talking, our website, people saw the website, trying to update our Facebook website, etc. And we ended up with 27. We needed 18. We ended up with 27 founding members. So I thought, good, I'm happy to go. So we had the 27. We moved forward with the building. And after that, we've built the building now. I just got a note from the builder saying on Tuesday they actually close off building the building, and now we're looking at outfitting it, you know, buying the cylinder, the cooling box, the tankage, all the rest, and we've already started that process. And up on everything you asked me? I'm sorry.
yeah, for sure. Could you tell our listeners where in Australia the
this is looking? If people know Sydney and Melbourne, they're the two main cities in Australia. This location is about midway between Sydney and Melbourne. It's in a place called Holbrook. Probably outside of Australia, nobody will know it, but the main town area around there is called Albury-Wodonga. It's a fairly major town by Australian standards. But this location is about midway between the two. It covers about, because Australia's concentrated in those two cities and all the rest, it almost covers 50% of Australia's population by being between Sydney and Melbourne. So we've got that as a good location. It's an area that has very low risk as far as earthquakes, fires, floods, and all the rest. Although Australia never has zero risk for fires. But as it happens, we lucked out and we're next door to a fire department building. So that was more luck than any that was great planning on my end. I put that in. But basically, we're next door to a fire department, the local fire department area. And the main thing is it's on the route, a major route for liquid nitrogen supply. And we may get into this later. You can almost have no electricity, no gas, no utilities, but if you've got liquid nitrogen supply, you can run for 2 to 3 weeks without too much of a problem.
What do you mean by a major route for liquid nitrogen supply?
It's on called the Hume Highway, which is a major highway between Melbourne and Sydney. And as it happens, all the liquid nitrogen supplies, there are three major ones in that area, use that as the main route. We're right off that Hume Highway. It's a main trucking route. They don't have to travel in the back streets and you know what I mean. This is a country town area. It could have been so out of line that they might have to travel 3 hours out of their way to get to our facility, but now they don't have to travel anywhere out of their way because they're moving up and down this Hume Highway all the time. It's a major route. And also that Albury-Wodonga is a major town area, let's call it. For Australia, it's big. It's a few hundred thousand. For Australia, that's a major town area. Everybody's in the capital city. Everybody's in the major cities in Australia, but that's a major area. And there's a lot of movement between those areas of this liquid nitrogen. especially up that Hume Highway. So we are part of that delivery route. We are within the delivery route.
Is there a substantial airport there as well?
At Albury-Wodonga, there is too. When you say a substantial airport, it's a local airport, but it's one of the bigger local airports. You know, it's not one. Planes fly regularly there. It's not like a small country town where a little, you know, two-seater flies there. These are proper planes flying there. So we have that as well. A lot, you've added one of the extra things that we also had to think about. And let me add, this is very important, the local government area, the mayor and all the rest, even though they're not believers in Cryonics, they were very happy for us to be there. They even were involved in newspaper articles where they said, we're not necessarily believing in Cryonics, but we like the idea that that they're going to come and be here and start their organization here. So we got a lot of local government support. In fact, we've got a lot of support through most of the governments in Australia that we dealt with.
And while we're on the topic, amongst Australians themselves, not just the government specifically, what's the sentiment like in regards to Cryonics, if there even is any?
There is, and it's very positive. And let me say, I know this from the media activity that we've had over the years. When we get interviewed by the media, it's actually a very positive interview. It's not an interview where they're trying to rip us to pieces or say anything. We get a lot of support and a lot of and a lot of the media actually being on our side. They might say they wouldn't want to do it themselves, and again, we'll get into why that is later on, but they're not necessarily taking a view that says this is a, for example, and it's not, but that, you know, that this is just a scam to take advantage of people or anything like that. Of course, we try to explain why and all the rest, that we're non-profit, but it's a very positive. Every one of our media interviews has been extremely positive. And we know from the people in Australia, and I think it's partly the demographics here, that Australians tend to be, and I mean, I know most other nationalities are the same, but they tend to be very open to new ideas. So I think that's one of the big reasons why in Australia we've had, to date, extremely positive reaction. I don't think we've had any negative reaction, in fact, to date, that is.
Yeah, that's really favorable conditions for the most part. I know
yes.
A lot of areas, you know, we encounter certain levels of negativity towards Cryonics.
So absolutely.
What about the legal environment for Cryonics in Australia?
In fact, it's a lot. There are no laws associated with Cryonics in a sense, because nobody's ever thought about it to write it into the laws. So we're operating very much within the current legal framework. And the biggest group that's involved with is the Department of Health of New South Wales. And we did something that was probably a wise move from the beginning. Again, it was well planned out, I have to say. It wasn't really, it was just the right thing, because we got in touch with the Department of Health in New South Wales and we asked them a lot of questions. We said, we want to do this. And we became very friendly and they were very supportive of what we're doing. So they're the ones that have the biggest influence over what we're doing, and they've become very supportive. They've given us a legal sign-off, you know, for the facility and things like that. They haven't, any time we've had an issue, it was more like discussing it with them rather than we'll see you in court or anything like that, you know, that type of thing. It was discussing, and they said, yes, you can do this. There's this way, there's that way to do it. If you want to go through a body donation program, you'd have to meet this criteria. If you want to go other ways, you have to meet that criteria. So, you know, we learnt a lot, and they realized we're a volunteer organization. It wasn't like we had a team of 20 professional lawyers to chase this up. But the law is, how can I say? There's no specific law for Cryonics in Australia, but there are laws that it comes within the ambit of, you know, it comes within that circle of those laws. And the legal structure is actually very good. There's obviously legal structure for how you can build. If you store liquid nitrogen, you have to have all these conditions, but that's normal for any sort of business, that, you know, you'd have to meet toxic weight, et cetera, et cetera. You'd have to meet all that. But for us, for Cryonics in particular, we've working within the legal environment very well, and we've been given a lot of options by the people who control that legal environment as to what we should be doing. I'm very supportive, very helpful. That's what I can say about that.
And presumably, like in the United States, Cryonics over there falls under the legal framework of, I guess, scientific donations, anatomical donations, or no?
No. sorry, that's not where we're going under. We're not under that category. Because one of the issues is in every state is different here. We're in the state of New South Wales, but some states are worse than more stringent. Basically, if you had a body donation program, you would almost have to be a hospital or a university. To meet the criteria that's required is a hospital or a university. So we are basically under the cemetery type legislation. We are essentially a cemetery. You know, we are classed as a cemetery. So we meet all the legal requirements to be classed as a cemetery.
And is there any way in which the legislation to classify what you're doing in that regard is not quite the right fit and you would, you know, wish or, you know, in the future work towards editing it, changing it, adjusting it to be a better fit?
You mean the cemetery legislation?
Yeah. So
no, the cemetery legislation is actually a perfect fit. The body donation program has so many constraints. As I said, you essentially have to be a university or a hospital. The maximum you can keep a body in the body donation program is 4 years. Great for chronics. So, but because the cemetery legislation, and we work very closely with the Department of Health, they explained it all to us. So we made sure we met. You know, you have to meet. We're cemetery entombment. We meet the entombment, you know, to be entombed because, you know, there's certain criteria. You have to meet this criteria. You have to be in a sealed container. You have to be et cetera, to meet the entombment. And we worked with them and we met everyone. In fact, we overmet the criteria that is needed for entombment. So that's the word, I think, entombment, yes.
I remember there was some other, I forget which one, maybe it was the Cryonics Institute, but there was some other organization where it was probably CI, when they were classified as a, I think it was a mortuary or cemetery, or such. They had to then abide by certain kinds of policies, which said something like, you have to be able to exhume the body within a certain amount of time and in a certain way, et cetera. Yes. That didn't make any sense whatsoever. Yes. You guys aren't, there's nothing like that affecting
there,
you.
There is. You would have to exhume the body. We are under cemetery. If there was something which was legally found to be a problem later on, I think you hit that situation at all times. We haven't really concerned ourselves with it because we don't expect us to be involved in those sorts of legal situations. For example, if somebody was murdered, and of course they were put into our facility, you may have to have it in a condition to be exhumed. The problem is if somebody was murdered too, they'd have to probably go through an autopsy. So they're not really much use for crimes as well. So we did look at that. It wasn't a big issue. As it happens, New South Wales has very great for crimes requirements as far as cemetery is concerned. The other major state, Victoria, which is our neighbour state where Melbourne is in, has very much more stringent requirements. They have a different legal system there for it. So we, again, great planning from my, actually, I did plan this one. We're in New South Wales. It was something that I planned to do. But no, there are some issues like that. There's also the problem in the US that they had was that being a cemetery didn't create the right connotations to people. You know, if you're trying to sell cryonics to somebody, but it doesn't seem to worry anybody here because it's funny. We're a scientific facility, but we just happen to be classed for legal purposes as a cemetery, if I can put it that way. Even the mayor of Holbrook, the area that we're in, said, yes, they're a scientific endeavor. And just because they meet the criteria for cemetery, you know, that's the legal aspect of it, but they're a scientific endeavor. So we're looking upon, you know, just so happens the land you happen to be on is zoned for cemetery, you know, as well. But a lot of land is zoned for cemetery and not used for cemetery either.
What about here in the United States? Sometimes there are issues transporting bodies between different states. You know, moving. Yes. I know California tends to have a number of problems, and if you die on a Friday, you're good luck because you're probably going to have to wait until Monday, things like that. Are there similar complications down in Australia?
There are, but they're minimal. The only one would be if you had some contagious disease is the major one that applies, you know, and again, under these conditions too. For example, Melbourne had a big outbreak recently of COVID-19. If you were passed away in Melbourne and wanted to be buried in New South Wales, there may be a lot of legal hurdles you had to jump or need to be frozen in New South Wales, needed to be suspended here. But normally, other than the ones that I just mentioned, normally it's not a major issue. It's normally not. Now, you know, there could be issues. If you want to get legal, there could be issues. But for example, in some states, some forms of suicide might be acceptable. Now, it may be acceptable in that state, but it may not be acceptable for that person to have committed and then go to be suspended in a state where it's not acceptable, and that's New South Wales. So you've always got to be in that situation. Somebody says, oh, good, I don't even know which state it is. I'm in Western Australia, which is another state. Suicide, I can just, you know, if I'm very sick, organized, assisted suicide.
Euthanasia.
Yeah, the word should come to my mind very easily, but it doesn't come to my mind. The reason why it should come to my I'll say that in another piece. But it should come to my mind, not for any reason that I'm going to go through euthanasia, but for another reason. But some places have assisted euthanasia. Western Australia, I believe, has some form. If you were to do it, New South Wales, where we are, does not. So there could be problems crossing the border. But for all normal situations, there aren't any major problems.
And going back a little bit to the startup plans, what would you say your largest expenses were for the beginning stages?
All right. Can I lead into that with a little bit more about the startup? Because there were four aspects of Cryonix that we wanted to do when we started up. Yes, we got the facility, but there were four aspects. What we were looking for was a sort of a one-stop shopping for Cryonix in Australia. I know that sounds nice words and all the rest of it, but that comes from my marketing background as well. So we wanted that. So we needed a facility. Of course, we needed a facility. Number two was, and this is, people underestimate how difficult this part is. And that was, we needed the ability to do standby at the hospital bed, to do the preparations that are needed, the transportation. All that has to be done very rapidly. You can't just say somebody passed away. And then what you do is you say, you know, we've got a couple of weeks to go in there. This has to be done almost within minutes. So we needed a whole organization. And we set up, our main organization is Southern Cryonix or Stasis Systems Australia. But we set up a second organization called CryoPath, and CryoPath does all the standby at the hospital bed, the transportation and all the rest. And it also can do it for overseas to the US. So for example, somebody like Elcor or CI may contact us if they have one of their people here who needs to be suspended, and we can organize for them to go overseas through CryoPath. That's two. The third one that we put together is an organization called Cryonix Services Australia. Now, that one helps you getting life insurance, setting up your economic situation, your finances, etc. It does all these sorts of things, because people will come to me and say, right, I'm there. How do I get the life insurance? How do I do this? They're not life insurance experts. They're not financial experts. I want to give a big disclaimer here, but they coordinate it and they can point you in the right direction. And they've had experience in who does it. So they can do almost, in fact, if you went into Cryonix Services Australia, they can do the works for you. They can organize you with CryoPath. They can organize you with Southern Cryonix. They can do the whole lot for you. Now, they do charge a fee. It's not a high fee, but there's on a per cost basis, Cryonix Services Australia, because they do a lot of the work, a lot of the background work. You could almost walk in the door there and walk out with an agreement. Then there's the fourth one. And the fourth one is to do with, a lot of people ask me, how do you put money aside for the longer term? And the fourth one is called Cryo Prime, and that's involved with long-term trusts. It was long-term trusts of that size are generally not legal. It's called a rule against perpetuities. A trust normally cannot last more than 80 years. There are ways around that. Some US states do that. You see, now you're getting all my economic, and some US states do that, but basically they don't really do it for Cryonix. We spent $70,000 to $80,000 putting together a trust that will work for 200 years, which is in most places almost impossible to do. So we did that. So we have what I call all the four pillars of Cryonix set up, and every one of them is ready to go as soon as our organization, our our Southern Cryonics facility is ready to go as well. So you can almost do this on a one-stop shopping basis. You can come in and get completely your whole cryonics experience, your whole cryonics sign up, everything done without sort of saying, how do I do this? And how do I go through the 100-page contract I have to sign? What are the things? Cryonic Services Australia will go through it with you and explain it all, etc. So each organization is sort of meant to blend together and hopefully make it as easy as possible for somebody to join a cryonics organization. Now, I did all that talking. I did the intro, and I can't even remember what your original question. Your question here was something to do with startup. I know.
Yeah. How expensive, and what are your largest expenses while starting up?
Okay. The largest expenses was the land itself, because we're in a country area, wasn't too bad. The largest expense was the building itself, but the building is very simple. It's almost a reinforced, strong, small warehouse. And then the big expenses are three items. They're the two big sort of fixed expenses. The big item expenses are the cryostats themselves. They're quite expensive, those cryostats. The tank that holds liquid nitrogen for storage until it's put into the cryostat. And there's an item called the cooling box where you put into where somebody, after they're suspended at a particular temperature, is actually put in and cooled to near minus 200 degrees centigrade using liquid nitrogen vapors and all this. It has to be done over a period of 3 or 4 days. They're the three largest items that we have. That's the largest items as far as getting the facility going is concerned.
You said something that I wanted to come back to real quick when you were describing all the various components, the various different companies, organizations that go into what the whole project is. And you were talking about the trust, the trust structure that would allow one to make an investment that would then pay off in a very long term when they come back. Yes. In a way, to me, that feels a little bit like reinventing the wheel. In other words, if there's already a good structure, or let's say a better legal structure, a more adequate legal structure for doing that in parts of the United States, why not simply have individuals in Australia create these trusts in the United States? I presume that can be done legally, creating an entity country.
The legally in another country can be done. But as I said, in the US, there are ways to do it, but they're not conducive to cryonics. Unless there may be some, maybe somebody else has paid, the $100,000 to, but there are about four or five criteria. It's not just the long-termness that has to be there for cryonics. There's a lot more than just that. The trust has to. I'm not going to get into all the legal because it'll give away what we spent $80,000 to develop. But basically, there's more than just overcoming the rule against perpetuities. In the US, the rule against perpetuities has been overcome in some states because of some tax advantages to overcome it. So the trusts have been set up in a way for those tax advantages, but they don't overcome the cryonics problem that are there. Actually, giving money back to somebody, a person, 200 years in the future. That's a bigger thing than organizing tax in such a way so that your future relatives, your future descendants can get a big tax break by not having to worry about the rule against. Do you understand the difference that I'm sort of saying?
Oh, yeah,
one is for taxes for a future generation. The other one is for giving money back to you. Who are you, by the way, 200 years in the future? And that's a completely different exercise. There's other issues too, where there are four basic issues that we had to overcome. The biggest is the rule against perpetuities, but there are getting money back to the same person. And the issue, I won't get into it because at the moment.
It's certainly a complicated problem, a thorny problem.
Complex. Yes, it's very complex. It took 3 years to do it. And as I said, about 70,000 Australian dollars to do it with. Top grade trust lawyers in Australia. So you can imagine that was quite an exercise.
Out of curiosity, can US cryonics members signed up in Alcor, CI, et cetera, can they?
Yes, they can. And we're talking to both CI and Alcor if they wish to use it. Now, having said that, it's going to cost them something. you know, we didn't pay $70,000 to just give it away, because the problem with giving it away is that somebody picks it up and says, oh, I know how to do that, and rushes off. But they do need the right place to do it and all the rest. That's where we hold. But it will cost something, but they can do it. Yes, they can.
When you say they can do it, you mean Alcor or CI? Or do you mean, anybody. I was thinking individuals, you know.
Anybody, that's what I mean. Individuals who are members of Alcor or CI, or any individual. If you said, I'm not a member of Alcor or CI, but the idea intrigues me of putting money away for 120 years, because you're at an age now that, looking at your age, you probably might either live forever, either in a real person or as a virtual person. And therefore, you know, the idea of putting some money now that might get me a lot in 200 years time might be of interest to me. You know, I'm making this up, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So where is the project now? What stage of rollout are you at?
I think I might have mentioned the builder, just sent me a note yesterday and said they're finished. They're signing off on the building itself. So the building itself is finished. The building itself is finished. It's been locked up. We don't have it outfitted yet. We've got orders out for the cryostat, for the tank, and remember I said they were the three major pieces of equipment, and the other one is this cooling box, which we're working on at the moment. So very specialized. They should be there by about March. The other very big item is the training. We need to do some very, very specific training for this. We had planned it for this year. We were going to get people like, and I think you mentioned Aaron Drake, who I know very well. He was going to come over and help us. We were talking about this very early this year. He was going to come over. We were going to get doctors, and we have subgroups here that involve with the perfusions and all these aspects of it. So we were all going to get them together later on. It was going to be later on this year. And then a very big crisis hit with COVID-19. You can't get people together. You can't bring people in from overseas. Interstate travel was a lot more difficult. So all that came to a halt until such time as what we understand where this COVID thing is going, because it's a major exercise to organize this meeting, and it's very expensive. And also people have to be hands-on together. They can't be you know, you at the end, like this, a Zoom conference. They actually have to be round the table talking. We were planning to run through some humanely done, because we've got some doctors involved, animal experimentations as well, and things like that, all done properly and ethically done, because, as I said, we have doctors on this group as well who are looking at this. So that we're hoping for is early next year. If all goes according to this great plan, that we should be able to open by early second quarter next year. Again, COVID-19 is the big if in all this. If that continues and travel is still difficult, even though it might be open, it might be difficult, we will have to delay that even more. But we're at that stage. We have our 27 founding members. We only needed 18, as I said. We have it open for people who want to join for full membership. Full membership is open up to such time as we open. You know, you can become a full member at the time we open. That's going to cost $70,000. I have two people that are very interested in that. So we may add our membership with another two people. That's 70 Australian dollars. That's another 70,000 Australian dollars. So we may end up with 30 people in the end before we get going. Once we get going, we shift into a different model. The model is then you are like a client customer, where like Alcor, like CI, you join with something like a life insurance policy and only pay at the time you're suspended. It's going to cost $150,000, and there's going to be $350 a year fee for that too. But they don't pay till maybe 50 years in the future. You know, they may not need to be suspended yet, so they don't pay, whereas the other people put all the money up front. The other group's sort of the investors. The other people are like the customers, the clients, if I can call them that.
And upon opening, will you be offering both neuro and whole body, or only one of those?
We're not sure yet. You know, like in all those sorts of things, it's one of these things where the neuro has a little bit more of that icky type factor associated with it. And we're not sure whether, we don't have any problems with it ourselves, but we're not sure as we're starting to market this and talking with people whether we'll offer it. But we may do it on a case-by-case basis. You know, we're not hard and fast on it, but we may end up doing it on a case-by-case basis, see how well that's accepted, and maybe offer it more later on. But at the moment, we're offering full body. Everything you see is related to full body suspensions.
I love how much you're really thinking about these different aspects, you know, the public perception and the marketing angles of this. I think a lot of times chironists get carried away, you know, and forget some of these very basic things about how to communicate what they're doing and the message.
Don't forget, I'm a marketer. My background was marketing. My background's marketing and long-range planning. So are the areas. Now, I may have missed some things, you know. As we used to say, try to do things. You'll end up dropping some balls anyway along the way, but hope that, you know, you don't make a complete mess of things, because there'll always be something unexpected that crops up. So, we know that, but I've tried to allow for as much as we can.
Cryonics needs more people with your kind of background. I think more people with a marketing and communications background and being able to actually describe these ideas to people and consider how they're going to be seen in the minds of potential customers and of course the public at large. You mentioned the cryostats. Where does one find? I take it's not, you know, you don't go onto Alibaba or Amazon and order cryostat. So
we had a lot of help from, let me put it this way, we had a lot of help from Elcor and Cryonics Institute in those things. But I don't want to get into the details of that at the moment, because they are difficult to get. You know, they're not something easy to get. They're quite difficult to get, and they're not cheap either. But we did get a lot of help from those organizations. They've been great with us. I mean, all I can do is thank them most profusely in everything we're doing. So even though we're sort of competitors, but we're not really competitors. We're just not really overlapping the same areas.
And what kind of cryoprotectants will you be using?
We're most likely going to use the Cryonics Institute, because that's available, easily available, the Cryonics Institute protectant, which is essentially a glycerol, human level antifreeze. If that's the question you're asking, they have a mixture. Their solution is actually easily available, and we will probably buy it from them, or we will make it ourselves here.
Able to say why it is that the other solution, I think it's called M22, by Alcor, it's not available, or is it under patent or something?
It's available but very expensive. I think it costs something like, and you know, the Elcor people, if they hear this, they'll jump up and down and say that's not the case. And I may be speaking out of turn, but it's the region of $20,000 for a suspension. The Cryonics Institute one, because it's covered by a lot of patents and it's got a lot of research backing and all the rest of it. The one for Cryonics Institute, I think, is of the order of $100, you know, less than $1,000. And I could be wrong. The one from Cryonics Institute is available on the web. You can actually, I know the formulation for it. My background's chemistry too, so I know how to make it if I had to make it. But the other one is a prepackaged, developed by, I've forgotten the name, 21st Century Medicine, the one from Elcor. And I think it's extremely expensive. And if I said 20,000 and it's wrong, I spoke completely out of turn. All I know is it's very expensive.
And I know you mentioned the price will be about $150,000.
Yeah, Australian dollars, yes.
Australian dollars. Does that include standby and transportation?
No, it doesn't. That would have to be done separately. And Stasis Systems or Southern Cryonics only does, similar to Cryonics Institute, you almost have to be at the gate. You have to appear at the door. I mean, a pre-suspended person at the door. So the standby and transportation will be done by this other organization I mentioned, CryoPath. The cost, depending on where somebody is in Australia, the cost is going to be something from about $5,000 to something like, could be $20,000, $25,000 Australian dollars, but depends on where they are in Australia, of course.
And do you depending on where they are in Australia, do you expect the vast majority of your customers to be from Australia? Do you expect anybody from the surrounding countries?
New Zealand is the only one that could be the case. And as it happens, our people who do the group that does the standby, and that is also represented in New Zealand, the professionals that do that are also. So it could be also New Zealand. We have not looked further afield than that at the moment. China might be possible, but I think it's unlikely because they have their own facility in China.
Yeah, Singapore, Taiwan, those areas perhaps.
Well, Thailand, but as it happens, one of our founding members is from Thailand. He's European living in Thailand, and he's one of our founding members. So you could argue yes for Thailand, but only because one of our founding members happens to live there. We have not looked there. We could get people there. We could very well, and maybe our step after we get going is to search into those areas as well and try to put some publicity in those areas. But at the moment, Australia is what we're looking for. And Australia has a low population too. So, you know, we're not trying to fool ourselves there. I think, what is it? Australia's 25 million. The US is 330 million. So the numbers that we need, luckily, are not very high. We need about, what was the number I had? I wanted to make sure I get the right number. We need about 5 clients a year. We have our founding members. We need 5 clients a year. And client doesn't mean suspensions. It means people who are joining up with us, becoming client type members. They may be suspended in 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is, 10 years, but we need 5 a year for us to be successful. So we need something like, I think the number is 150 in 30 years for us to be successful the way we are at the moment. So we don't need big numbers, but we can't operate if it's zero. It won't be zero. And I'll tell you why I'm sure it won't be zero. And that is that I had estimated we get 16 to 18 founding members and they had to lay out $50,000 at the beginning and we got 27. So it won't be zero. The 5, I think, is conservative because I always forecast on a conservative basis. So I think we should be okay with the 5 a year. And that's clients, again, not suspensions. That's clients who will be suspended in the normal course of events over the future.
Hopefully it'll be orders of magnitude larger than that prediction.
Yeah, although, and that was something else everyone discussed, I'm not sure we need that many people. Chronix is a funny business model, if I could put it that way. This is heresy in the Chronix world, what I'm about to say, but I don't think Chronix needs too many people involved in Chronix. And the reason is because Chronix is very simple. Chronix doesn't need many people to be involved, but when you have a lot of people, you get a lot of focus, you got a lot of attention, you get a lot of negative aspects being brought up. And especially if you consider the sorts of money we might have put away in these trusts and all the rest, there could be influences which are not positive. So 5 is good, 10 is better, 20 a year might even be better. But if you told me we've got 100 people a year, I'd start worrying a little bit. It's more than what I think we'd want to do.
I would say every individual that goes into a stasis pod is potentially an individual that can come out of a stasis pod. So that's, you know, that's a good in and of itself.
Good for the person, for the individual. Yes, of course. But you've got to remember that most people don't want to live forever. let's start with that. I'll bring up something as an aside, but I was watching something a little while ago, Aubrey de Grey, I don't know whether you know Aubrey de Grey. Mm-hmm. He's involved very much in long life and longevity. And he's also a member, I think, of Elcor. But I was watching him at a conference, a fairly professional level people. He was at a conference and it was done by somebody hosting the conference. And he asked him, he said, let's ask the audience how many people here want to live extremely long lives, not forever, extremely long lives. What, there would have been 400 people there, 3 or 4 put their hands up that they wanted to live extremely long lives. And then the person asked, and I can give you the link to this website, he said, turned to Aubrey and he said, is that a surprise? He says, unfortunately, it's not. Most people don't want to live extremely long lives. They want to live, if you ask the average person, they want to live the average lifespan, whatever that average lifespan is, I suppose. If you were 40 or 50 years ago and was 65 years old, you probably should be dead by now. If you're 80, you should be killed off because you probably said, I wanted to live to 65. But basically, most people don't want to live forever. So the numbers in Chronix are very small. I mean, I don't know whether you know, but Chronix has been going for about 50 years and there might be about 3,000 people who are members of organizations in the world. That's after 50 years or so, 3,000 people. There are about 300 suspended. So, you know, I mean, there are groups that got more than that just by doing nothing. So 3,000, we don't expect many here. And actually, I don't see it as being that much of a problem. As I said, the Chronix really what it does is it suspends you so that science, technology, information technology, all the rest have a chance to develop the processes to bring you back to life. It's not like in cryonics, you need to set up a research organization to do this, and you need to do this, and you need money to do this. I couldn't care in the least. As long as I'm suspended in something that will allow me to put the word sleep for 200 years, there's, what's the numbers? I've got the numbers here. $600 billion a year being spent on medical and science research for people to cure all the diseases, to make people live longer, to make people live better life. There's additional research sent on brain preservation techniques. I think it's billions of dollars. Hypothermic medicine, which is low temperature medicine. Cloning, billions of dollars. Nanotechnology, which is needed, billions of dollars. Computing power. Mind uploading, which you might get to, artificial intelligence. I worked out there's almost $1 trillion a year being spent so that when I've got a chance in 200 years to come back to hopefully bring me back to life, and I don't have to do anything. Basically, as long as the organization can keep me supplied with liquid nitrogen, which is critical, and have people who are dedicated enough to look after me through that time period, I've got a chance. And then we have to straight away say, there are no guarantees in cryonics. Nothing says people will come back. There's just some probability of it happening.
I do find the psychology behind what you were saying, how people don't seem to be, when you ask a lot of people, do you want to live, you know, let's not say forever, let's at least say indefinitely.
Long lives.
Very
long lives, yes.
You'll get to decide, you know, when you want to put an end to it in 10,000 years when you're bored.
Yeah.
I find that psychology fascinating because I think what's really going on is that a lot of these individuals, when they hear the question, do you want to live forever, they're not really processing it in the way that you and I might process that question. Instead, they replace what seems like an insurmountably difficult question with an easier question, which is they conceptualize a very old person and the struggles that a very old person goes through. And they think, how long do I want to put up with that? And they think, well, I don't want to put up with that very long at all. And so their answer is, no, of course, I wouldn't want to live forever because of that. But what I think that suggests is it's actually very hard to know how many people would be interested in this if it were more real. The question was sort of more connected to their reality, which I don't think it is right now. It's right now a little bit like asking a parrot, you know, what do you think about the weather? And it says, oh, the weather is great. Oh. It doesn't mean much. It's not information dense.
But there's one thing against that, one thing for that. The one thing against that is that the people that Aubrey de Grey was talking to was not talking about cryonics. He was talking about living extremely long lives in a healthy body, because his whole idea is to keep your, reduce all diseases. You wouldn't have diseases. So the people, I hope, understood, maybe it wasn't completely understood, but that they would have a healthy body. Yeah, that, because I think that's also far out of people's normal comprehension to think that you will have a healthy body like that. That was a thing that I thought was interesting, because the other thing that I think I agree with you is that, taking my example of going back, say, 40 or 50 years and taking somebody who's 50 and you ask, how long would you like to live? And they say, oh, about the average life, which is about 70 years old or whatever it is. If you ask that same person now and he's 85 and say, you said you want to live to 70, because that was the average life went at that time. Oh, no. Now I want to live the average life now, which might be 85 or 8. So people in their minds sort of feel, in my thinking, that they want to live this average life, whatever it is, not understanding that that average life has changed over a period of time. So whenever I ask people, I say, oh, so you mean you should be dead by now? Because it's maybe an 80-year-old. They say, no, an average life. I said, but that was 70 years old a few years ago. So why don't we just kill off everybody above 65? Then we meet your moral criteria for not wanting to live forever. But anyway, I know that's a side thing, but it's just that I think what you're saying is that these are top-of-the-mind type thoughts that come to people when they're thrown that question, rather than something that perhaps they pursue a little bit more in thinking it through. Because Aubrey de Grey did ask the question slightly differently and said, and then ask them, how many people want to die from a horrible Parkinson's disease, dementia type illness, which is what you're likely to get? And everybody said, no, I don't want to do that. You know, so everybody, I think, thinks that their death is going to be, you go to bed one night feeling quite all right, and then you just don't wake up in the morning. Nice, pleasant. They don't realize that it could be years of suffering, years of going through this. So when you ask the question differently, how many people want to suffer for 5 years? Nobody wants to suffer for 5 years. So in curing all these things, you would not have to suffer because you wouldn't have all these diseases around. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but there's some interesting philosophical ones. Like there are a lot of, Kreinich brings out the philosopher in people. And I try not to go into the philosophical areas because then these sorts of interviews will last something like 20 hours, you know.
But that's some of the most interesting stuff.
I know I know it is. And it's very interesting. But the issue with it is, and this is why I fight against doing it, I love having the discussions, but it takes me away from the time that I have to actually do something practical, like build the facility, start the organization. And if people send me all questions like that, and I try not to answer them in too much depth because, again, I get a lot of other questions. I'm continually getting questions about the facility itself, how they're going, how people would join, all these things. And I concentrate my efforts on that and getting it going. Although I love the other aspects. When I sit back and really retire, I'm going to twiddle my thumbs and think about all those things as well. Because there's so many questions that are raised in this and I'll leave it to you to ask me what you want to.
I'll bridge the philosophical and the more practical.
Yes, yes.
So say, assuming there's some, you know, massive shift in public opinion about Kreinich's, and you know, you've stated that for the record, you think it's going to stay pretty small, but who knows what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So say, you know, the Australian population becomes enamored with the idea of Kreinich's. Could you see yourself closing your doors at 100, which is the number you used, or do you feel like you'd have to rise to meet the level of need?
It's a good question. I think we would probably rise to meet the level of need. I mean, but it could happen. Obviously, it could happen. We would rise to meet because we are the only organization. But then don't forget, if it got to that level, starting a Kreinich's organization is actually not too hard. If you're a corporation with $1 million, you could start one tomorrow without going through all the stuff that we did to do that. It's not that difficult. It's difficult for us because we had to start by getting the financing, making sure everybody was on side, building up over time, finding the land, knowing the legal system. Now that we've done it, if you're, I don't know, pick a large company in Australia, they wouldn't do this, but let's say a BHP, a large company, they could build it tomorrow. They could do it tomorrow if they needed to, because they already know all the pieces that are there. It's not hard to duplicate. And we don't care. To be honest, if somebody said to me there were going to be 200 Kreinich's organizations in Australia in 5 years, I'd be happy. That means what you are saying is correct. I'd be happy I wouldn't see them as competition. I'd see it as everybody's interested in Kreinich's, but I still have this problem in my mind that I think it's probably not the right number because a lot of attention then will come on Kreinich's. Do you meet this legal system? New laws will come out. Look, there's a lot of money. These people have billions of dollars invested here. We better change our tax structure to do this. What are we going to do? How could we ever bring back in the future 20,000, 30,000, a million people now suspended? Whereas if you've got 200, 300 people, nobody's going to be sitting there and saying, hey, you're ever going to bring back 300 people? Who cares in the future population about 300? So a whole lot of issues get raised as it becomes bigger, but we would obviously go with whatever direction it goes.
I think you're describing the tall poppy syndrome. Is that yes, accurate?
Yes, part of that is that the once we get noticed, we are now flying below the radar, and we're in a great position flying below the radar. I wouldn't mind a certain number more than what we currently are forecasting to have, but we can survive on what we have. If we become too big, we hit, as you said, that tall poppy. And I think anywhere, maybe that's an Australian term, but I think we hit that anywhere in the world. That once you get very noticed, people, I mean, it could even be the situation where you are big, you didn't get noticed, then people start resenting you and say, look, this was available 20 years ago and you never told us anything about it. And I lost my mother and my father. I could have done this. Of course, because in 20 years' time, this might be very normal to do. You know, it's become established, but they don't realize that now nobody wants to do it. So people get very angry. You can get very negative reactions because my mother and father died when they couldn't have died had you made more of this. Because in the future, this is an established thing. Everybody does it. But 20 years ago, now it's not. Now they'd never think about it. But in 20 years, they don't remember what they thought 20 years ago. They start thinking, and you can get a big negative reaction to something. And you could say, but you never wanted to do it. They say, no, you never explained it properly. Had you explained it properly, we would have wanted to do it. So we're now the Anti-Chronics League of Australia or whatever it is, because you let my mother and father die. And I'm making all this up.
The worst is when they're going to override their memory. They say, no, 20 years ago, I absolutely was totally in favor of this. And I've always been in favor of this.
Yes, that's right. That's normal. Isn't that different phases of a new idea where people, one idea is it's impossible. Then by the end, they're saying, I was always in favor of this. But that's why you can get into more problems. I won't be around to have to worry about those problems, but I might be suspended somewhere, and I don't want those problems being hit by the organization that I'm suspended with. So, and I could be wrong. It could be that it's so well accepted that everybody says this is normal. You know, this is the new normal. We don't have to worry about being against it or anything. It's there. You know, it's like a car. You're not against a car. It's there in a sense.
And to play devil's advocate, wouldn't having, you know, a larger member base and more resources be a tool in itself to kind of defend yourself against these issues that would come up?
Yeah, it could very well be. But I think we're going to hit, look, if we got into the millions and millions, you could be right as a member base. But we're all right now. But to build to that, we're going to hit a sort of a bad situation. We're going to hit a situation where we're not going to be strong enough to fight it, but we're going to be very vulnerable. And that's our difficult point, I think, in what we're doing. And this is, you know, we're speculating. We don't know. We're building, we put a basis, a few assumptions, and then we're saying what could happen, which is what we do well.
You're describing sort of a delicate uncanny valley effect.
Yes, exactly. And that worries me because I'm going to probably be suspended at the time that occurs. And that could last 5 years, but it could also last 20, 30, 40 years, And again, there could be large amounts of money being kept in things, trusts and things like that. You know, it's just, you've just become a focus for this sort of thing.
And the hope is that, you know, and this is what I'm kind of betting on, and that is that Chronics members and the next generations who have family members who have been cryopreserved will be, you know, have a really strong familial genetic incentive to make sure that nothing happens to their relatives. I know if, you know, if my grandmother was preserved and you know, someone's attacking cryonics, you know, you can bet your ass I'm going to be, you know, really on top of that and very as strong of an advocate as I could be.
All right. Let me give you another series. I agree with you. Sorry, I don't disagree with that. I think one more generation away, though, they couldn't care in the least what happened to their great-grandmother or whatever. So that's a problem. The other problem is, let's also say that your grandmother had, and I don't know whether we want to go this way, but had $50 billion somewhere by now built up. And you know that if she's no longer suspended, you grab the $50 billion. You know what I mean? There's money can escalate very quickly. If you even at very conservative rates, it can escalate very quickly. I always say I don't want a lot of people to be involved in these long-term trusts as a matter of interest, but let's say that there's a financial aspect. Let's say it's not you, it's your children, and it becomes their great-grandmother, and they wouldn't know their great-grandmother from the guy 10 doors down or something. So, you know, there's a lot of factors in this that we could probably talk about, but
somewhat on this play organizationally, how do you plan on aligning, you know, board members and you know, people running the organization in the long run with the long term incentives of the members and the money that will have been built up in the trust?
Okay, the trust is a separate organization. One thing I've done is I've kept everything in different organizations, so the people who are involved in Cryonics with Southern Cryonics don't have anything to do. Southern Cryonics doesn't have to, anything to do with the trust funds. Of course, the funds would go to the people if they were, I mean, the patients there, the funds would go to them, but the actual people running Southern Cryonics, as it happens now, we're all intermarried in a sense because we all started. But I'm hoping over time that these become separate organizations, one run as it gets bigger by professionals in each of these organizations, so that we don't get this this thing of one group wanting to do something that affects the other group. So we have, as I said, we have the Cryopath, the standby type organization. We have the Southern Cryonics, which is the storage. We have a trust organization, and we have a sort of an umbrella type organization. It actually can do anything of those within that organization. You can actually do it with the overseas organizations as well if you want to go there. There's my biggest task when this facility is built and operating is to find my successors. That's going to be my biggest task. Now, we have some funds for employee type money, but it's not a lot because we're not expecting a lot of employees to look after these things. But my biggest task is to find my successors. There are people out there who are interested in this who can easily become my successors, but I need, that's my job. Basically, once this thing is built, my job is to find successors in all these organizations. And there are people out there, but I haven't had enough time now to chase it all up because I'm trying to get the whole thing going.
Yeah, no, I love to see that long-term thinking. That's a very hallmark of good cryonists.
Yeah, well, it has to be. It has to be because you're talking, I think one of the issues sometimes, even people who ask questions about cryonics who are not cryonists themselves, is that they tend to think as though it's something's next year, or I'm going to be around and I'm going to be, but what are you going to do about this, Peter, in 20 years? 20 years, I'm going to be dead. I'm probably going to be suspended in 20 years. So I have to think about what my successor will do, not what I will be doing at that time. Yeah. If I'm in a wheelchair somewhere or whatever, who knows?
Aubrey de Grey may say that you're going to be around for more than 20.
And that suits me fine. I mean, if that's the case, I'm very happy to go that path. As I said, I always forecast, not pessimist, but I'm very conservative. I always allow a lot of upside in my forecasts. And again, that's what I said, a good forecasting model allows you to see not what the future is going to be, but what current issues are and how sensitive the future is to those current issues. And you're now talking to me wearing my 10 years of strategic planning management, worldwide planning management.
This is going from 10 years of strategic planning to, 300 years of strategic planning.
Yeah, 300. Planning. But even when I was in the oil industry, our projects were always 50 to 100 years into the future. We used to look at projects in that sort of time frame. So I was very used to long term. And when I say 10 years, I meant my experience in it. But whenever I look forward, we always used to look a long way, at least 50 years into the future. So
I was going to say, I know you said 200 years a few times earlier. And is that, so obviously you're going to be planning for, unknown amounts of time.
Yes.
But would you say you have a personal opinion on what you, when you think the technology for revival is going to catch up, stating upfront that nobody can really know and we're just speculating.
Okay. My thinking and why I picked 200 years, 200, 250 years is, that I think the way things are, let's put it aside, barring any major, event in humanity that destroys mankind, atomic wars, global warming, you name it, major pandemic diseases, which we're going through, but bar any that actually destroy mankind, I think 200 years is about the time that I look at how far we've advanced in the last 200 years or so. And I look at things moving geometrically, improving geometrically upwards. And I say, a lot of people say 100 years or so, we should be in a position to be able to do this. I always take the forecast and roughly double them, where people are. I did a lot of projects where you do IT type projects. And people say, look, in 3 years, we could do that. I always took what they said they could do in 3 years and said 6 years and then doubled the amount that it would cost as well. That's basically why I'm picking the 200, because a lot of people are saying about 100 odd years we should be in this position. I'm saying it's probably going to be 200 years. I also feel that at 200 years, we hit a sort of a sweet spot where these existential type things really will become really brewing. So, you know, I don't know, that Chronic's possibility will go down the more chance there is of atomic warfare and all these other things. But again, as you said, nobody knows. I pick some numbers and just rounded them up in my head. I do think, though, we may have a chance, and you mentioned it before, and you may have seen this in my video, but I think we have a chance to, through brain uploading, to come back earlier than that. I think in some sort of virtual form, we may be able to come back before that time period. You may have seen it in my video, but I think, this is Peter Solokidis talking, again, it may be heresy, but I think what could happen is in about 70 to 100 years, we may have the capability to upload brains, and we will be able to take the suspended patients and upload their brains into a sort of a virtual world at that time. In that time, they can catch up with history, they can live whatever lives they want, they can do whatever they want, it'll be all real to them. Then, I think in 200 years, a body of some sort will be available. That's my magic 200 years that I'm talking about. It'll be available. They may want to stay in the virtual world, but they might say, I want to transfer to the real world again.
On this note, and I feel like Max may have an objection to this.
Go ahead.
So to get technical on what you're actually signing up for, so are you leaving open the possibility in the contract someone would have to sign to be a member that you're going to leave it up to the future people to decide whether it's a biological revival or a mind uploading revival? Can you choose that? Can you say you don't want that? There's a handful of people in the Chronics community who have strong opinions about mind uploading versus, you know, pure biological revival, and okay, you know, some people don't feel comfortable with it, or they understand it but they feel like that's not me, and for whatever reason, and you know,
yes,
it's a little bit of a philosophical question.
Yes.
So I guess what options
would be to not do it. We would give in the contract the option to not do it. We give a lot of flexibility as to how you want to come back. They're different, and I, by the way, I'm talking about non-destructive mind uploading. I'm not talking about where it actually destroys what's suspended there. So it's a non-destructive type mind uploading. Whether it's possible or not is another thing. We're again speculating. But you're right, people will have a chance to not do it. But it answers the question in my mind. A lot of people say, I'll wake up in 200 years in a body and I won't know anything. It doesn't have to be the you that's learning it. You could be your second you up there in this virtual world learning it, and then just pass the knowledge back again to the real you that wakes up in 200 years time. It doesn't have to be. Again, we're getting into philosophical areas here, and we're getting into what's possible. In fact, it can be 200 years if we put it that way, but let's not get completely into the realm of possibilities. But basically, it answers the question about people saying they don't know what will be happening. If you're uploaded, non-destructively uploaded into a virtual world, and in that virtual world, you pick up everything that's learned in the last 70 years since you were suspended. You live a life and know what's going on in the current world all the time. And now 200 years pass by, your body brain, whatever it is, has now a body to be brought to life again. Let's assume that. The memories and things can also be joined with the memories that you had in the others, so you know what's going on. And therefore, in 250 years, you wake up a viable person who understands everything that went on, knows what's going on, and is very prepared for that time period of 250 years in the future. That's my thinking. This is my opinion of how I think it could go.
So, I mean, I just wanted to make sure to get across the point for anybody concerned after you said that, that you have the option to say what you do or don't want, or at least, you know, stating what you would want in the future, whether or not the future people are going to be, you know, willing or capable of obliging. That's another story.
Of course.
Peter, let me see if I can help you to perhaps receive less mail on this subject,
if I get it, that'll be good. I'd be amazed. Sorry.
Or who knows? Maybe this may backfire, and you'll have 10 times as much. But I'm curious about a couple of your thoughts here. So, let's say that you were put into a coma tomorrow, mm-hmm. not
bio, not in a stasis chamber, no cryo, nothing. Yes. Just you're in a coma. And the day after tomorrow, a week later, some amazing technology is developed that can perfectly well scan your brain molecule by molecule.
Yes.
You know, it can get every single the position, the spin and and position of every single atom in your brain.
Understand. Yeah.
Very, very high resolution. And then can be replicated simulated in some sort of digital substrate, to perfection, very, very, very well.
So it would seem real to me. Whatever that entity is in that substrate would
feel real. Yeah.
Okay.
And it would, functionally, it would react exactly as you would in real life. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's even upload. It's connected to some sort of robot, so it's able to interact in the real world, in our world.
Okay. Yes.
Maybe not. Maybe it's just simulated and interacting in a second life kind of scenario. And then this entity decides, actually, you know what? I'm perfectly happy. I like this new existence. That old body there, just get rid of it. We don't need it I don't need it anymore. That's mm-hmm. really not, I don't find that useful anymore. It's in a coma. It won't know anything. It's just get rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make you uncomfortable, or not make you uncomfortable?
It doesn't make me so uncomfortable, but I can understand how it could make some people uncomfortable. And it picks up on the previous question. We would have to have some protection in what we're doing to say that entity there, it's interesting, that entity there, how much power it has over the original body, how much say it has over the original body. Because, it could be, if let's further your assumption a little bit more. Let's further it that this is commonplace. Everybody can do that. Then maybe that second entity has legal status. Now, is that legal status the same as the original person status? And I don't know the answers to this, but when we get into this philosophical area, I've thought about a lot of this stuff too. Does that mean that they can access the trusts that are there? Does that mean they have say over what's happening? If they are legally me, let's say, they can do a lot of things that I may not want to do. Now, when I say I, maybe that's I. maybe that's the I. So, you get into a whole lot of areas that are going to be very difficult to think through. It's interesting in my mind is that here's the interesting thing. If you're brought back with every molecule, and I'll bring up another philosophical point, and you think a particular way, you think a way that says, that body's my body there. I don't want anything to happen to it. The body brought back, I think, is you up to that point. Of course, it starts branching into different, thinking processes and all this. But the core part of that body is you. I'm almost sure if you were all your life saying to yourself, I never want to get rid of that body, I want to keep it, the you that gets resurrected may be thinking the same. Now, you could say in 50 years whether the you that gets resurrected says the same thing. But then the question might be, 50 years has passed. It's an awful long time. That coma body isn't doing anything in that 50 years. So I have a feeling because it's you, it's going to have, at the beginning, your exact thought processes, your wants, your way of thinking about things, your morals, so you probably won't get rid of that body quickly because you'll probably say, no, I don't want to do that. I might be back in there someday. Or maybe you're like me and says, who cares in the least? that was an old thing, but I didn't care before I went under. If you know what I mean, I didn't care. It wasn't part of my basic makeup, if I can say it that way. So I have a feeling you'll probably come out a bit like that. And yes, if I don't know how many, if there's 1,000 people and one is a mistake, then one is a mistake. You're still living in some sort of entity. Nothing is going to be perfect. Nothing is going to work perfect. We just hope statistically things work out better than what we set it up in such a way so that statistically they work out better. Let me phrase it that way.
It's interesting how our philosophical, our ethical intuitions, our metaphysical intuitions, thinking about these kinds of problems kind of stretches them to their limits.
Yes.
And we start saying, well, my intuition is X and somebody else's intuition may be Y, and mm-hmm. It's difficult to imagine fully being able to resolve those conundrums in a way that everybody is satisfied with.
I agree. And, you say we reproduce into one substrate. What if we put you into five and then pick the number, and then you hit with a whole lot of philosophical problems? Or maybe if you hit in five, there's no philosophical problem because the answer is none of them are you now. You know, legally, you can't have five you, so maybe you take on a separate legal. Who knows? There's so many things. You know what would be interesting? It would be interesting to find all this stuff out. Now, one of the questions that people always ask me is, why do you want to be suspended? Why do you want to live into the future? All these sorts of questions are the sort of questions that are going to be answered in the future. They may not be the answers that I want to know, but if Cryonics works, all these things that niggle at my, or at least niggle my curiosity, you know, twiggle me, you know, in my mind, and that the sort, I might have made up a word, twiggle, but anyway, but the sorts of things that I'd love to see the answers to, all these philosophical issues, scientific problems, physics problems, all the rest. I'm very interested to see the answers to all those. And that's one, curiosity is one of the big reasons why I would love to be suspended and love to come back. And if I don't come back, then I'm not worse off than being buried underground somewhere. So
I think, like so many questions in philosophy, we may end up realizing that the problem was, is we were confused about how we were asking the question.
You're right. We didn't set the parameters correctly. We didn't define our terms correctly, because so many times you might be talking about something, I might be talking, but we've defined the terms completely differently in these things. So, and we both think we're right. We're saying, I just can't see how Max can't understand. And you're saying, I don't know why Peter isn't.
Why doesn't he get this?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
We have to define twiggle first, so we can both know twiggle, what we're talking
about. I just meant yes. I meant something that scratches at my mind, you know, things that scratch at my mind. I think I picked up a few words and joined them together because I couldn't think of the right word. My memory is not the greatest memory. And luckily, even though I'm 70 years old, you could say it's age, and part of it may be age, but even when I was young, I never had a good memory. I had a good way to reason things, but I didn't have a good memory to remember things. So 5 minutes after I hear a person's name, I almost forget it almost straight away. So I'm not very good.
Hopefully that'll be very different, when we come out of these pods and in some point in the future in some form.
Well, even now, if you think about it, these days I have almost infinite knowledge. I mean, and I can create memory. I can take a picture of anything at any time, and that creates the memory for me. It's in my phone. I can look up Google at any time, and I have almost infinite knowledge on anything. People can ask me a question. Now, you can ask me almost anything, and if you don't catch my eyes quickly looking into Google, I can actually start sounding. I may not, but I can sound like I know what I'm talking about in almost any topic you could pick at the moment. That's the level we are. We've almost hit that level where we are combined with the machine. In the future, I think it'll be a lot better than that. Yes, the memory will be there automatically. I think, again, none of it is sure. All we're doing is speculating based on, I think, trends. Our speculation, not just we just pulled something out of the air. We're speculating based on the trends we see now. And that's what Cryonics, I think, is speculation based on the trends that we see now.
And the next stage is, you know, right now, like you're saying, if you want to know something or look something up, it's easy to do that very quickly and add that. But of course, what we humans are able to do that AI is not yet able to do very well is abstractly conceptualize something. But they're getting there. I mean, a GPT-3 is very impressive.
Very. I'm also very a big fan on what's happening in AI. And I am amazed at the level of development that's going on in that area. In fact, I can program, not that well, I won't say I can. I can do some programming where it uses, what is it, TensorFlow and some of these things. I've done some that use it, but at a very basic level. You know the one that recognizes pictures and says, this is a man, I did get it. There were errors in the program, in the program they'd written, not the TensorFlow part, because it links onto TensorFlow, but in Python itself, they'd put errors in there. I said, that can't be right. I don't know how to program Python, but I said, that can't be right. And I fixed it up and it worked quite well. I was quite amazed. I'm a good programmer, by the way. If I have to be, I'm a reasonably good, even when I was young, that was the area that was probably my strength, even though I did chemistry. Because just to show you something, you may want to cut this out, just to show you what a great forecaster I am. This is a great forecaster of the future. When I was entering university in 19, 1968, I entered university and I had a choice. I was really good with computer programming and that for in 1968. I could almost create it in my mind. But I said, computer programming and that versus chemistry, there's not going to be much future. Computer programming or coding or those things. I better stay with chemistry. So I did chemistry. You could see the strength of my forecasting capabilities. But that's what I picked at that time.
I think you're in good company, though. A lot of people, a lot of very smart people didn't see that. They didn't see it coming.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't see it the way it became. I saw it as being very interesting, something, but I didn't see the way it would become in the future. But I've always kept up with it. I've always tried to keep up with what's going on in that area. Physics, chemistry, biology, information technology, AI are areas that are, and also business type related matters, which all come together, by the way, in Cryonics. Sorry, you can.
Yeah, that's
I've branched into separate subjects. I'm sorry.
No.
I was comfortable talking, so I went into that area.
No, you should be. Me and Max frequently discuss the amount of kind of confluence of types of areas that have to come together for people to believe in Cryonics and to become interested in it. So you do find a huge amount of, you know, intelligent, curious people in this field who
very have much
so many different interests. I mean, it's quite astonishing. I've never seen a group of people who are quite this rounded in their knowledge, a whole bunch of kind of jack of all trades.
Agree. Yeah, and that's exactly what I found. I've spoken to the people in Cryonics Institute, the people at Elcor, the people in the UK Cryonics facility, or not facility, but the Cryonics organization, the people that I meet with here. I am really amazed. I mean, if you see the demographics, though, of those people interested in Cryonics, basically the demographics is STEM sort of background or STEM interest, strong interest, very positive about the future. Not very religious, not very religious, mostly male. I mean, that's, I don't know whether that's whatever it is, but mostly male. They're the main demographics. And that's where I always target our talking and things towards that demographics. That's why it never works when you do it on normal media. It never hits that demographic.
And speaking of targeting, how do you plan, or what's your strategy for reaching the potential customers in Australia?
At the moment, I think we're going to stay with our, let me just get this up again because I think I've lost you. Yeah, we're going to stay with our internet presence and approach on the internet. We've got Facebook, we've got our internet. The internet is there, but I haven't, when I say our web page, I mean by internet. But basically, it's going to be an internet type approach through all the Facebook and then maybe some internet advertising, if I can put it that way. But we haven't really thought that through at the moment.
Maybe some podcasting.
Podcasting would be great. I mean, I'd love to do more of this, but I'm not very good at it. So somebody else would have to do the podcasting. But the people in Australia, I think I only need 5 a year. We have our Facebook page, and this is not meaningful because I never pay how much, you know, the hits on Facebook page and all the rest are, but they only started with 100. But when we finished our facility, we got 1,000 people interested with a lot of comments coming on that. So there's a lot of people interested in joining us once we actually get going. But I haven't yet got the process as to what we're physically going to do to actively recruit people. In fact, one of the people we're going to hire, or at least on a part-time basis, is going to have that as their job. There's a lot of avenues that we're thinking about exploring. Even, you know, this is a lot. I don't want to get into it now, but we haven't got anything specific. I think the early days will get people just through knowing us and knowing that the facility was going. But I think after that, we'll probably have to work for it. After about a year or two, when we've got the low-hanging fruit that people call, and they're grapefruit too because they'll join us, I think after that we'll have to find ways and work for it. And maybe it's word of mouth. Maybe it's just knowing that we're here. Maybe at that stage, these media things that didn't have much effect for us when we were asking people to put $50,000 up front, maybe they'll have a lot of effect for us when people know they can do it through a life insurance policy and not have to worry about it till 20, 30 years in the future.
Let me ask you something, Peter, which is a thought that has occurred to me in the past. One of the
most useful things that is coming that accrues from having different cryonics organizations spread out in different parts of the world is that if anything happens in certain jurisdictions, then other jurisdictions in a very different part of the world in a different political system, mm-hmm. et cetera, can essentially carry the torch for cryonics going forward. So for example, if things turn against cryonics, I understand there's a new organization starting up in Russia. Or has started up in Russia.
Has started, it's been there for about 10 years.
There's
one in China. There's a new one in China, if that's what you might be thinking.
Yep, the Yinfeng Institute in China. So if things turn the wrong direction politically or illegally or et cetera for these different organizations, it's very good that there are individuals like yourself, organizations like your organization doing this in a place like Australia. Do you see what you're doing as essentially creating this kind of backup, this fail safe, you know, this plan C for individuals? You know, for example, Daniel and I live here in the United States. If something happens nationally where, you know, there's legislation against cryonics or whatever, I know that I certainly, I'm sure Daniel would be very interested in going and, you know, being a part of your endeavor. So, have you planned at all like that? Have you thought strategically about what that could look like?
You know,
a very long term,
very,
I know.
Very broadly, because to be honest, no. But if in 10 years' time you say, gee, wasn't it great that you had that organization in Australia and that Russia or whatever it was had to close down and they could go there, you know, I'd say, yes, it was very well planned at the time. But to be honest, no. There is a second issue in that, which, you know, but the issue of once you're already suspended, can you go somewhere else? And the US has more facilities so they can go somewhere else. Australia will only have one. We could probably get a few people to the overseas facilities if we had to, but that's probably an issue in itself. That I've done a lot of thinking about, that if you're already suspended, not as the backup option, although, you know, as the fail-safe backup option, I haven't thought about that, but I have thought about how, if we had a few people suspended and the climate turned against us, everything turned against us here, what would we do if somebody's in those things? And we've thought about that too, how to handle it. I don't know whether we've got the definitive answer yet, but we have done a lot of thinking on that. That's more a practical aspect. The other one is more strategic, but the other one will sort of fall into place automatically. You know what I mean? You don't even have to think about doing anything in the other one. If something happens in the US, then that will fall automatically, except that one thing, Australia tends to follow the US, so you might find 10 years later Australia's in the same position. I don't think so for cryonics, and maybe less so in the US, because the US was many times driven by a very strong religious fervor in the US, which is less so now than what it once used to be, and is almost not there in Australia. I think that's one of the reasons why it's accepted fairly easily in Australia. It's really strange, you know, with all these things that we get asked in Australia about cryonics, very few times have I ever been asked the question, will it work? You know, I mean, I always say, look, we're not sure. It's, you know, it's no guarantees in cryonics, I always say. But very few people come at me and say, look, I'm not interested in that because it won't work. It's almost like, yes, it will work, but it's not for me. Do you know the difference in the thinking there? It will work, but it's not for me. Or it will work, but it's too expensive. Or, you know, sorry, they don't actually say it will work, but they don't bring it up as a rationale for why they're not interested in cryonics. So basically that's interesting as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, whenever you do a media exercise, they always have somebody at the end. And I actually encourage the media people to have somebody at the end who says, no, it won't. You know, some scientist comes out and says, this won't work because of this and this reason. I say, please do it. We want to be questioned. This is, hopefully we're attacking this as a scientific endeavor. If a scientific endeavor says nobody can question what you're doing, then it's not a scientific endeavor. And they come up with ideas. And afterwards, I'm going to say, I could have thought 10 better reasons why it wouldn't work than what this person is coming up with. And their thinking is very short term. A lot of times they're thinking, no, that's impossible. Because in the back of most scientists' mind, they're thinking, in 10 years' time, it's impossible. You know, their time frame is 10 years' time. It'd be a very, very, very self-confident scientists who said, no, in 200 years time, that's impossible. I don't know who would ever, if they said that, I wouldn't believe they were a scientist.
And you might have the wherewithal to convince them otherwise, but not in that traditional media format. Not enough time.
There's not enough time. You're right.
We could talk for hours here and we're barely hitting, exactly, you know, the tip of the iceberg. So practically impossible to do that, you know, in 10 minute slots.
Exactly. And in fact, I don't even try. In fact, what I recommend to the people is I'll have my say and let the other person have their say and they can conclude with the other person. But again, I don't mind, you know, that they should have somebody who is putting an opposing point of view. Again, if we're looking at science has to be built on the idea that everybody has a reasonable say in it, and therefore in that say, we hopefully come to the best conclusions in the end. Hopefully, you know, that's where we end up with.
And actually, on that subject, though, since you brought it up, what is your estimate, if you're willing to share, of the likelihood that you think that this will actually, you know, somebody who goes into cryostasis tomorrow, you know, given the best techniques and, you know, with a good preservation, et cetera, all as good conditions as we can make it, the likelihood that they will actually be revived at some point in the future, either uploaded in a useful way or biologically?
Okay. I think the uploading part has a much greater chance of success because I think it'll be earlier. I would put that very high with the uploading part. I'm going to say greater than 50%, okay, for the uploading. It may even be higher than that for the uploading. The actual bringing back, I find that tougher. I'd say zero at the beginning, you know, for the first 10, 20 years, I say 0%. But in my magic 200 years, I would say around the 50% mark, climbing to around the 50% mark. But I have no real rationale for that other than just what I told you before, how I got to it. I'm never going to say it's 100%, but I do think the uploading part is probably higher than that and earlier. That's just looking at what's happening at the moment. I did a calculation. How did you get to 70 years for the uploading? And I did the calculation. I think I worked out that that they uploaded 200 neurons, I think it was, recently. And then I said, science doubles every year. And to get to the, whatever it is, 80 billion neurons doubles every 2 years. Science doubles every 2 years. To get to the 80 billion neurons of a human being from 200, if the computing power and science doubles every year and a half, that takes you about 60 to 70 years. That's how I got to that magic calculation. And I thought, and that was the closest I could get to something that I hung to. But I really think that the uploading part will be available. I really do see the brain, mind, whatever it is, as a physical entity. Well, a program is, let's call it the same way as a program, whether you call a computer program a physical entity or not, but it is a physical entity. I see it that way. I don't see some other piece. If there is another piece to it that I didn't, then it may never be possible. But if it's just as I see it as a physical entity, I really can't see why. If we can do this number now, why in 70, 80, 90, whatever years, we can't do a whole human brain uploaded into a virtual world, a real virtual world, a virtual world that feels solid, real, everything else. That's my thinking.
Well, I'm surprised to hear you say you think the uploading has a higher percentage chance of viability than the biological revival. I guess my thinking on this would be that with biological revival, the things we would have to surmount have to do with bringing back a known entity, whereas with uploading we need to understand it almost perfectly to translate it properly, you know, into, you know, a non-biological form. Whereas with biology, we're not trying to reinvent that perfectly. We're just being like, how do you get it from being, you know, in stasis to being, you know, warmed and working. So I guess I'm curious as to why you think that the uploading would be easier.
Just before I answer your question, why I think, I can see your point of view because I think about it the same way. I always think about it, your point, this is your point of view, which I sympathize a lot with too. I think about your point of view as sort of representing, if you're reproducing sound, it was a lot easier to do it with an analog record because it just basically reproduced a vibration that was there. When you had to do it digitally, you really had to get into the high technology to do it. So you're sort of saying that the brain that's physically sitting there to be brought back again is more like an analog record, whereas the uploading is more like a digital one. It's a lot more technology. You could be right. Look, I don't know. It's just to me that we've already done some work in the uploading part and we can see aspects of how to do it. But you've got a brain that you have to do so much. You have to almost cure every disease possible. You have to prevent it from the poisoning that goes on from the cryoprotectants. I always look at cryoprotectants like a big hammer. It's just about to crush that cell, but because you've frozen it, you've kept you have to somehow find a way to reverse that. You have to do a lot of things to that that I think are going to be possible in time, but I still see that more difficult than scanning something and uploading it into something that is 70, 80 years more advanced than what we currently have now. That's my thinking. And it could be an AI. It could be an AI that basically it's not, it's a you, but in an AI sense of you, you know, if I can put it that way, you know, and that's my, but again, yeah, you could be 100% right.
I don't have any huge certainty on my perspective either. Yeah. It probably comes down more to kind of whether you have a bias towards biology or a stronger familiarity with high tech, and then it kind of makes it easier to imagine, you know, and extrapolate into the future.
And if we're both right, we end up both fairly quickly, both come together fairly quickly.
Now, quickly, I wanted to double back to Southern Chronics and how you viewed how you view the organization's role or how specific you view the role. So there, you know, you could obviously, you know, first and foremost, the actual preservation process and storage. Mm-hmm. But do you see yourself branching into the politics, the culture, scientific advancement, or do you see it very much just preserve and wait?
For now, it's preserve and wait. We have an organization in Australia, of which I'm also a member, called Cryonics Association of Australasia, which is like, it's also like a peak body for all the, it's supposed to be when we get going to set standards, not let somebody who opens up a funeral parlor and sees cryonics is good and next day says, I also offer cryonics as well. It's to set standards as to what we do. And all the cryonics organizations, which I'm involved in, most of them, are involved in that. I see that as being the political part, the bit that does the advocacy, the part that does all these things. I want to keep, in my mind, and it might change because I'm not going to be there forever, I'd like to keep Southern Chronics and the other organizations, again, out of, you know, under the limelight. I don't want them to be in the middle of controversy, because once our problem in most Chronics organizations is that once there are legal disputes, once there are lawsuits, we could end up going broke just from a lawsuit, you know, because people saw us and said, maybe we can make some money here, or maybe we can get some money back, maybe we can do that. So we want to be out of the main focus. But that other Chronics Association of Australasia is one that would probably handle all those aspects that you talked about. And I'm involved with that too.
So kind of like the trust, you want to keep it just all separate.
Yeah, separate. And that's, yes, as a separate, so that we don't end up, we don't want legal battles. We don't want to fight the legal battles.
Leave that to some other organization to fight, yes, so that you guys are out of the fray.
Yes, and also that the legal battles is one of my reasons for not having a gigantic membership either, that I was talking about before. Nobody notices you when you're a few hundred people here or there. So
now this next question does not take into account your desire to be small. Just as a hypothetical, if you had one of your first members, you know, left their massive estate to you in their will, you know, we're gonna go with a ridiculous number of $1 billion, right? Yes. And all of a sudden you are working with $1 billion as a upstart chronics company. Mm-hmm. How would you see yourself utilizing that money?
I haven't thought of that size, that scale of funds, but I did think that I'll get to that scale in a second, but we did think, like, I myself will probably leave substantial amounts to the, and not, now I'm not talking anywhere near the, what you just said, but I think a lot of people are planning to leave for the organization. The organizations do depend on that sort of money for their long, we don't in my base forecasting, but we, but it's great icing on the cake to make sure that you never have a major incident that could end up bankrupting you. So $1 billion, I think we would just probably build another facility, maybe under a different organization. The advantage of having two facilities is if something goes wrong with one, we can always have a second one to do. Our chances of something going wrong with $1 billion is not as great as what it was with what we currently have, but it would be good to have a few through Australia. They're very easy to operate, so we'd have a few through Australia. And on top of that, I think we would just make sure the facility, I wouldn't go out and advertise more. So we might put more, we might do a little bit more, but not the $1 billion that you expect more. We would do more promotion, more media, maybe more of that to get more people, but it would not be so that we become gigantic, in my mind anyway. I think I'd use it more to make sure that the facility is, its longevity is assured, if I can put it that way. That to me is more important sometimes than what it is, the money. We need to make sure that this thing will last for 200 years. We may have more staff. We may have things like that. But
you think you would do something like build underground or in the side of a mountain? Or
we might, yes, we might do that. Yes, there's plenty of, with that sort of funding, we've got plenty of choices as to what we could do. We could be a lot more creative. But again, all that would be based on making sure we have longevity in the organization, that we are fiscally and morally and whatever other aspects you want to say, last for a very long time. And people-wise, last for a very long time. I mean, by the way, with that sort of money, you could probably set together an organization that becomes a 20-person organization. And once you're an organization, the organization with the people in it has eternal life. And I mean, if it's got 20 people, even though they turn over because the same principles. We're doing it with Cryonics, but we wouldn't have the employee power. We have to employ, we have a lot of volunteer help, and that doesn't always carry on. But we're hoping it will, because it's so strong at the moment.
Would you consider with, that wouldn't take $1 billion, but would you consider with some amount of funds creating field cryopreservation stations, field cryopreservation clinics, et cetera, in Melbourne and in Sydney?
What do you mean by field
cryopreservation? Well, to be able to do the process of, so instead of just stabilization and then transporting to the facility, yeah. Actually doing the whole perfusion and vitrification and the whole preservation at a very close to, so they're inside of say in a small clinic in Sydney, and then you have as much time as necessary to transport the body over to its final, you know, final place of waiting. I don't want to say final resting place. It's not quite the right way to put it, but but yeah, you essentially, since you've done the procedure locally, then all you have to do is have a, you know, space to hold a few bodies or such while they wait to be transported to the final destination.
We already do that. Basically, okay. I should have gone through the process, but basically we already do that. What the process is, can I just quickly run through it and you can fit this in wherever you want to. This is our process. This is how it would work. Basically what we would do is we have CryoPath as an emergency, that other organization, as an emergency response at the hospital bed. Now, it sounds obvious. Okay, no problem. That would be professionals. We're using a company called Australian Blood Management, who have doctors on the start. They're professional perfusionists. Perfusion is where you pump these various chemicals and things through the body. But they do that. And what they will do is they would be at the hospital bed to cool the patient down. After the patient is declared legally dead, that's when we can commence the cooling. We also apply ice packs, cardiopulmonary support, anticoagulant, heparin, whatever it is, and prevent clogging. It's important to keep the oxygen to the blood. Okay, now that continues and we transport the person to the funeral directors. So far you're saying, you're not telling me anything new, Peter. Why are you worried? Why you want to go to all this? Now at the funeral, this Australian Blood Management has the capability to actually do the perfusion at the funeral facility, basically on location. We do the perfusion. What we do with the, that's the perfusion. You know, we actually put through the cryoprotectants into the person. We then cool the person to about minus 80 degrees, and that's dry ice temperature. Now, at dry ice temperature, they have about 2 weeks before there's any major degradation. They're also in just before the vitrification transition stage. So we're in a glucky type stage, you know, I don't know how to call it, but they're semi-liquid type stage in there, which means that people can be moved without any fear of cracking and all the other possibilities that can happen. So they've got about 2 weeks. If they were going overseas, we would then transport them overseas. If they're in Australia, what happens is we take them to the facility, but we've got 2 weeks to do that. So we've already done the perfusion. We've already done all we do at the facility is bring them to liquid nitrogen temperature. They're at dry ice temperature now, about minus 80. They then get brought to liquid nitrogen temperature slowly in a cooling box at the facility and then stored at the facility. So that's all the facility does. So basically, all the perfusion, all the work is being done sort of on off-site at the location, almost at the location. We need some place. You could even do it if we had to do it. We haven't tested. Hasn't been tested in an ambulance. You could hire an ambulance. You could do the perfusion in the ambulance if you really had to do it in the ambulance at that time. But then they have to be at minus 80 degrees. Dry ice, which is minus 78, but minus 80 degrees centigrade after that perfusion. They have to be at that temperature. They can't be allowed to come up again.
And like you said, if it were any lower, there would be the risk of cracking.
We transition. But you see, it's coincidence. This is amazing coincidence. But dry ice is minus 80, so it's before the transition state, which I think is about minus 130. But minus 80 is very good because what happens is you don't have, it's solidifying, it transitioning. So you don't have to worry about how you transport the person because they're not able to, there's no cracking possible. The cracking's the big problem after they become vitrified completely. I always call that a pre-vitrification stage, and then there's full vitrification after they go through that. So yes, we can do it. And that really makes the procedure very much so, almost very short term. You don't have to just cool somebody to normal water temperature and then take 2 weeks to transport them or a week to transport them. They're at that dry ice and they have 2 weeks automatically there. Did that answer your question in a very long-winded way?
No, that's great. That's great. I think it's especially important to hear that part about the fact that if somebody is brought down to liquid nitrogen temperatures and then transported, there's quite a risk there of damage.
Big risk. Yeah. And what happens is the reason why they're brought to liquid nitrogen very slowly in this cooling box, it's over 3 or 4 days. What you do is you cool, then you bring up the temperature, not past the transition, bring it up again. You cool, bring it up. And the reason is to prevent stresses that can cause cracking in the brain. So you're trying to minimize cracking in the brain. Because if you're just to put somebody in liquid nitrogen straight away, there's a good chance the brain could just start cracking or cracks could start forming. So you do it very slowly. You bring the temperature back in, it releases stresses, you take it back down again, so it's an exercise in itself. And there's a special container that we haven't yet purchased that you do that. It's called the cooling box. It's all computer controlled and, it's a very sophisticated piece of equipment, but they're very rare because they're only with chronics organizations are the only ones that need them.
Well, it's great stuff because it's very important for newcomers to chronics to understand that people like yourself and the scientists in the fields are thinking about these problems. We're not just, putting you in a freezer and being like, okay, it's done. It's not straight freeze. These are smart people and we're thinking about the issues and what could go wrong on a very detailed level. So it's not
very much so,
it's not as straightforward as one would assume.
Yeah. And again, I have to give credit to all our friends in Elcor and Cryonics Institute and even the UK. They've helped us a lot in pointing all this stuff out. When I did the tour over there, they helped us. They made me understand helped me understand everything that was going on. And also I've had in contact with them. So we're a good community together, if I can say that.
And speaking of community, do you ever foresee like a trade organization, an international trade organization for chronics?
How would it work?
Pooling resources for the shared purpose of advocating research,
Could be.
Because to a certain extent, with a really interconnected world, if you start having political problems over there, you know, in Australia, it's gonna not just stay isolated in Australia. We're gonna have people over here start feeling the same way. And so, to a certain extent, we have to control the narrative for Chronics across the whole globe.
Agree. And so, yeah, I'm sorry. No, basically, if we're in Australia and doing that, we would do that through this Chronics Association of Australasia that I'm also an executive person on that too. They sort of handle anything that would be, look, we would be talking with everybody. We're too small to just keep it. This organization does that and this does that. We're not that compartmentalized, if I can find that word. But officially, we'd be doing it through the Chronics Association of Australasia, and they would be the ones who would be talking with the various organizations overseas, but so would we. I'm a member of both, so I mean, it would be just there's to be really honest, in Australia there's probably about 3, maybe 4 or 5 people that are what I would call active in Chronics, really active. I mean, know most of what's going on in Chronics. There's that small group. On top of that, then there's a layer outside that of people who have some interest, have volunteered for some things, but don't sort of know all the pieces. There's probably 2 of us that know every piece, you know, almost every piece. Together, we know almost every piece. So, you know, that's why one of the big things I have to do when I get started is make sure I have my successor all trained up for the next few years.
Well, Peter, you've been incredibly generous with your time, and we like to go out with a short little segment, and we just have a handful of these. It's overrated or underrated. So we just ask you, you know, on a particular idea or mm-hmm. what have you, and you let us know if you think this is, you know, too much attention is being paid to this, or it's overrated or not enough.
Okay.
So the first one is...
What about aldehyde? Just enough attention. No. I mean, I'm just saying that's another possibility.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Spot right in the middle.
Yeah.
Aldehyde stabilized preservation.
I think it's underrated at the moment. Not enough attention is being paid. My thinking. It works nicely with my idea about the uploading. not that I would want it for Chronics, but it's a separate exercise, but I think it's underrated at the moment.
Is that something your organization is looking into as potentially offering in the future, or?
Only looking at the moment, because it's not strictly Chronics, although I think the two could come together. If you are wanting to be preserved, suspended, but you said, look, I don't mind, I can be brought up as a, you know, bring me into a virtual machine. That's exactly what I want. You know, in fact, a lot of people are saying that. I don't want to be brought back as a body, then to me, that would be the better way to be suspended. There's more chance in that one, in my mind, than what there would be if you were suspended in the old way, you know, in the proper way, in the Chronics way.
But you're still opting for the full Chronics way,
for
yourself.
I'm still opting for the full one for myself and all the rest of it. But if that's all that was available and the science really showed that we're very close to being able to upload on that basis, then I might change my mind. I'm at the moment full Chronics is my base position, but you know, things change in 10 years, a different thinking process might occur, but I think the aldehyde stabilizer is a little bit underrated at the moment. I don't think it's getting enough world attention. Forget Chronic circles, forget aldehyde stabilized circles, forget all those circles. I don't think it's getting enough attention in other areas that it should, in my mind anyway. Considering all the people working on it and the people who are very high team, people who are skeptical about all these things and all the rest of it, I'm surprised it doesn't get more attention. But anyway.
And I foresee a certain number of listeners not knowing exactly what aldehyde preservation is and how it differs from traditional chronic solution preservation. Could you kind of briefly explain the difference?
We'll also have notes in the show notes, links in the show notes about this.
Okay. As I understand it, in aldehyde preservation, what happens is the brain structure is kept completely intact before the freezing process. There's no way, you know, basically it's frozen in place, you know, with used aldehyde. I mean, it's a system that basically what it does is it, as I said, the brain structure is kept in place. So when it's frozen, It doesn't shrink. It doesn't change shape. It doesn't do anything. It's sitting in exactly the shape it was at the time the person passed away. That means that the, what are they called? The interconnectons or whatever else it is, all stay in place. I think that's what the magic name, I'm not an expert here, but all stay in place. So it should be easier in the future for that to be uploaded because everything is kept in the same place as what it was at the time it was frozen. With cryonics, the brain shrinks. That magic, you know, so some of these things could change. The thinking is they don't change much, but some of the connections could change in the way they're connected within the brain. The thinking is that the connectons, or whatever they're called, you might know the term properly, but that they actually stay reasonably in place, but they could move. There's this magic hammer of this aldehyde, not the aldehyde, but the cryoprotectant, which is ready to destroy the cell. So there's a lot of things going on with that. It should be easier to bring somebody like that back because apparently it's impossible to bring somebody back once their aldehyde stabilized. But it's probably easier to upload. A shrunken brain should be easier to bring back, even though some of the structures may not be exactly intact. Hopefully they can be repaired because, you know, you could work out where they were in the first place. It should be easier to bring that back into a physical form. But maybe much harder to, although I think it's probably the same, but it may be harder to bring back in an uploaded form. Picking up on the point. So the difference is that one really isn't conducive to the other immediately anyway. And it could be that aldehyde stabilize can bring somebody back a lot earlier in a virtual form. It's very possible they can come back.
I've heard Greg Fahey try to describe the difference between the two. And I think you did a reasonably good job at that. So.
Use the word reasonably because I don't think it was that great. It's not that easy. I'm not an expert in them. And in fact, I probably should have written down what the difference was a lot before. This just stays in my mind. But basically, that's one is the brain structure remains intact. The other one in cryonics, it actually does have some shrinkage and perhaps some cracking going on in that case. But it's more chance, though, of it staying the way it was before. You know, the one is to do the connections kept in place. The other one is the whole brain is somehow still there. You know, so anyway, it depends which way you look at it. Sorry, so you can chop every bit out and make it sound reasonable when you edit it, because I'm sure that didn't sound all that good.
our second overrated or underrated. So you've had a chance to live in the United States and now you're living in Australia. So overrated or underrated, life in Australia in comparison to life in the other parts of the Anglosphere?
Overrated, I think. Australia's about the same, in my opinion. And depends, of course, where you're living. So, but about the same. I've lived in the UK, I've lived in Australia, and I've lived in US. In all times, I lived in nice areas, so you can't say. I had a lot more to do in the US and the UK, a lot more range of activities and a lot more things that can be done. The attitudes, though, to things in Australia are a little bit different, too. There are more, you know, it's a newer country. It's even newer than the US, of course. So things are more open. People are not as closed-minded about things that they might have been, especially new things like this. But the US is probably, I think it's overrated that Australia is better as a place to live. But I've lived in all three, and I think all of them I thoroughly enjoyed. I can't say I didn't enjoy them.
And presumably you lived in Sydney or in Melbourne.
I live in Sydney. I have lived in Melbourne. I grew up in Melbourne, but I've lived in Sydney most of my adult life when I was in Australia. But don't forget, I left Sydney in 1984 and came back to Australia in 2008. So I was away almost 28 years. I lived in Japan 12 years. I lived in Thailand 6 years. I lived in Singapore 2 years. I lived in the US 4 years. I've lived in the UK. It was short in the UK. It was only a year in the UK. So I've traveled. I think there was one other one, but anyway, Malaysia, I lived for a short time too. But I would say that living in Australia is overrated, but I mean, it's a nice place to live. I enjoyed retiring here, but there are things that you can't do here that you can do in the US. Things are more expensive in Australia than what they are in the US generally. The US is such a big country. You have so much choice of things, so many possibilities, so many places to go. England is the same way. UK is the same way because you have all of Europe. Forget coronavirus activities for the moment, but you have all of Europe to go to if you want to go and visit all those places. The foods, the chain, the different cultures, the way you mix with people, all the rest of it is so much wider in those countries. It's mainly population. Australia's only 25 million people, but Australia's a lovely place too. If you're an outdoors person, Australia might be a little bit better. I'm not as much an outdoors person.
Well, you're saying you're saying there's not as much to do in Australia. Australia doesn't have as many, doesn't have access to the same
degree. For example, I'm interested in theatre. For example, Australia has almost zero theatre, whereas the US and England has stacks of theatre. Wines, I've got a big interest in wines. Australia has good wines, but it doesn't have access to the same level of wines. In Australia, basically any wine you buy is an Australian wine. In the US, you can buy anywhere from around the world. In England, you buy anywhere from around the world. Restaurants, the food ranges in the countries, pick something, and your range in the US is far greater than what, and in the UK is far greater than what it would be in Australia. Sporting activities, though, Australia probably has a lot more, but you can just as easily get as much as all that in the US. I lived in North Virginia when I was there. Lovely. I'd never seen so much green area. Where 5 million people lived, I'd never seen such a green area as what I did when I was living in North Virginia. It was just near outside Washington, D.C. I'd never seen an area that green, that lovely. So the season changes, first time in my life I actually saw season changes. You know, so there's a lot there. The UK, the same. But there's a lot to be said. I'd say Australia's overrated. It's as good as those. But again, it depends where you're living.
Well, thanks to your efforts, you know, cryonics is going to be one of those things that you can do now in Australia.
Yes, that's right. You can do that, and you can do it here. Or if you're still interested in being suspended in the US, we have a whole organization that can get you to the US as well. That CryoPath also can handle the US if you're still interested in being suspended in the US. So, yeah. So, look, I like Australia. I love Australia. I mean, I was virtually born here. But basically, those other places are really nice places, especially where you've lived, where I've lived. Now, if I was poor, I think I'd prefer to be poor in Australia than poor in any of those two countries. Middle class, I think I'd be just as good any of those countries. But poor, I think Australia would probably be better if you're in the poorer end than any of those countries. There's more social benefits you get in Australia if you're poor. Yeah.
So the final the cryopreservation of pets.
We are not sure whether we're going to do it. I don't care one way or the other. It's the cryopreservation of pets is a money spinner. That's all it is. Basically, the cryonics organizations make money from it. I don't know why people would want their pets suspended and then them not suspended. That's the funny thing that I find people suspend their pets. And I say, what, your dog's going to come back in 50 years time or whatever, 100, and you're not going to be there? Oh, they said, I never thought of that. So basically, preservation of pets has two purposes. One is it makes money for the cryonics organization because it's very easy to do. You don't have the same things as what would happen with a person. And also, you charge. The second thing is it's an entree in the US means differently. It's a starter to be able to get the person involved in cryonics. If your dog and two cats is suspended, you are a lot more favorably thinking about the idea of suspending yourself. Because I always throw the question at them, what do you do when your dog comes back in 70 years and you're dead? I said, oh, yeah, my dog would be very lonely at that time.
I had no idea there were people who actually did this, who would sign up their pets and not themselves.
Yes, yes. And in fact, a lot of people do that. And what it is it's a great way for cryonics organizations to actually use that person. So now that your pet's suspended, what about yourself? Do you want to think about that? Yeah. And also it makes money for the cryonics organization. Mm-hmm. Cryonics organizations, not that it makes profits, but they need a lot of money to keep operating. They need money, not a lot, but money to keep operating. Did that sort of answer your question?
Yeah.
Maybe I answered it in a very clinical, I should have said, oh, the poor dog. I love dogs, by the way. Let me say that, I love dogs. So, you know.
Well, thank you very much for... thank you, Peter, for coming on today to the Cryonics Underground podcast.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the sort of questions you asked me. I hope I answered them in some way that was reasonable. Some of them are very personal opinions too, you know, and you probably will appreciate that. But I want to thank both of you. I want to thank both of you for even taking the time to do this sort of thing. You can only help Chronix, and that's what I, anything that helps Chronix, I'm very interested in.
Hopefully when you actually, you know, fully open, we'll have you back on and you can update us on everything that's been going on.
Yeah, I enjoyed the time. I enjoyed your very intelligent questions. And you will certainly be top of my list for people to talk to if you want to talk to me again. Or maybe you'll find somebody who's a little bit better, who is more eloquent than what I am, and maybe they can do a better job.
Well, you're one of those people who's actually making this really happen rather than just talking about it. So that's the most important thing, the most important people out there. Thanks. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your time. Take care of yourselves both. Bye then. Bye.
Bye. All right, that was Peter Salakides, the man bringing Chronix to the land down under. Daniel, what did you think of that?
I thought it was a great discussion. Peter was really fun to talk to. He's very humble, which is always important. I really did enjoy talking to him, and I think he's a great representative for Chronix. I was also happy to have this conversation at the time that we did, because I feel like we're getting to witness a brand new Chronix organization, and the first one on the Australian continent for that matter. And it feels kind of like a new birth. Furthermore, I thought it was fascinating to get a sneak peek into how Southern Chronix has to contend with the reality of, you know, a completely new and untested landscape. So I had a really good time.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought so as well. It's good that we're getting more diversification of the Chronix community into more and more countries now that we are getting Tomorrow Biostasis over in Europe, Southern Chronix down in Australia. It seems like there's a lot of movement. And of course, the folks in China and the folks in Russia. Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of movement lately to kind of diversify the field, which is good. From not only from the fact that a lot of people are going to have access to it that may not have had access to it before, but from a sort of a risk and hedging perspective. It's hedging against the risk that any individual country, any individual culture is going to turn against Chronix. Because if that happens, then there are going to be many options for those of us who are interested in taking those options. So, and hopefully that becomes easier to do over the years as these companies get more established. So I'm excited for what Peter's doing. I'm glad that it's taking place. Like I've always thought that there was kind of an overrepresentation of people interested in this subject in Chronix in Australia and in New Zealand. So it's good to see that he is officially bringing it to the area. And I wish him the best. I hope we can have him back on at some point when he has moved the endeavor forward and he can tell us how it's going.
Yeah, absolutely.
As always, please find us on the Cryosphere Discord server. Links will be down in the description. Links from the show, a few show notes will be down there as well. You can always email us at chronixunderground@gmail.com. And we will see you all on the next one.